except for the children. So, Assam, all those, Mahurutev, at one time, Ekasmin, simultaneously, Anana Agarishu, in different compartments, Yoshitam, of the women, Savidam, with perfect rituals. Jagrahe, accepted. Panin, hands. Anurupaha, exactly to match. Swamaya, by his internal potency. So, translation. All those princesses were lodged in different apartments, and the Lord simultaneously assumed different bodily expansions exactly matching each and every princess. He accepted their hands in perfect rituals by his internal potency. So purport by his divine grace, Śrīla Prabhupāda, Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai. In the Brahma Saṅhita, 5th chapter, text 33, the Lord is described as follows in regard to his innumerable plenary expansions. Advaitam, achutam, anadam, anantarupam, adyam, purana, purusham, navayovanam, cha, vedeshudulabamadulabamadmabhaktau, govindamari purusham, tamaham, bhajami. The Lord Govinda, whom I worship, is the original personality of Godhead. He is none different from his innumerable plenary expansions, who are all infallible, original, and unlimited, and who have eternal forms. Although he is primeval, the oldest personality, he is always fresh and young. By his internal potency, the Lord can expand himself into various personalities as of Swayam Prakash, and again into Prabhava and Vaibhava forms, and all of them are none different from one another. The forms into which the Lord expanded to marry the princesses in different apartments were all slightly different, just to match each and every one of them. They are called Vaibhava Bilas, forms of the Lord, and are affected by his internal potency, Yoga Maya. So, Asam Mahurta He Kazmin, Nanagareshu Yoshitam, Savanam Jagrahe Panin, Anurupa Swamaya. So Om Magana Timaranda Shaganjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmeditam Yena Tasmai Shigurave Namaha. So this is a very interesting story about the Lord saving the princesses that were kidnapped by this demon Bomasura. And there's many things we can learn from this story, many lessons. One lesson that comes to mind is the lesson of association and the importance of association. For example, we have Bomasura, who is actually the son of the Supreme Personality of God. It's interesting how Krishna, had Bomasura as a son. Krishna was in the form of Lord Bor, and in the form of Lord Bor, he lifted up the earth planet, and as he was lifting up the earth planet, he lifted up the earth planet with his tusks. That is, you know, the boar has big, those are teeth for boars, anyway. So he lifted up the earth planet with his tusks, and because the Lord has interchangeable senses, that's a spiritual body, you can do anything, and he can do anything. You can also, if you have a spiritual body, you can do anything with any part of your body that you want. You can eat with your eyes. You can see with your ears. It sounds pretty weird, but it's there in the spiritual body. Because the material body is limited by just by the structure. Just like we see when someone, we've had a number of devotees have had strokes. Everyone knows what a stroke is. Stroke is when you have a brain hemorrhage or something like that, or a clot. And when the nervous system becomes interfered with or dead or something like that, then you can no longer move a hand or feel what's happening in a certain part of your body, or if you have spinal injury or something like that. But the spiritual bodies are not actually composed of the same substances. They're not tri dhatuke, bile, mucus, and air. They don't have nerves. They don't have veins. In fact, the Vedic literatures tell us, Ashnavi Ram, there's no veins in the Lord's body. And those of us who are getting older, I guess that's everybody, it's getting older. When you get older, you get to see your veins more and more. See? Veins. Anyway, so that's what happens. But the some of you will get older. So the Lord doesn't have veins, nor do we have veins in our spiritual body. And one may think, you know, how is this happening? You know, how do you have circulation of blood? You don't need blood in the spiritual body. It's all pure consciousness that is Satchitananda Vigraha. And we don't really understand that at the present time, so it's best not to project our understandings, our mundane understandings, upon the spiritual body. But in any case, the Lord can do anything with any part of his body, so when he touched the earth planet, the earth became impregnated. And a nice, cute little baby was born. His name was Boma. And he was actually a good guy. Because there's two aspects to raising children, or in general, anybody. One is called nature, and the other one is called nurture. These are interesting words. Nature means basically what you're born with. And of course, we're born with a certain type of mentality from the previous births. And that mentality is the subtle body. As Krishna says in the Gita, the subtle body is something like the air carrying aromas from one place to another. So we have a certain mentality, and you can see that with children. I mean, when children are born, they actually have a certain psychology even before they have any sort of association or training or anything like that, even from the very birth, those of you who've had children. So that's our conditioning in the material world. Now, in addition to that, you also have what's called nurture. Nurture means what happens after you're born. You know, whether you've got parents who beat you all the time, so that when you grow up later, you're scared. Just like I deal with people in certain cultures, I won't mention where, that when they were young, generally, they were beaten into submission. You know, if the children did anything wrong, that they were just like, you know, beaten. Anything little wrong, or the father would beat them regularly, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child type of stuff. In certain cultures, it's like that, in certain parts of the world. So then, when they get older, it's interesting. When they get older, not that I keep beating them, but but they only respond to that sort of dynamic. In other words, if you're going to be a GBC or a temple president, you've got to be really heavy with these people because they don't respond to the sort of dynamic, would you please do this, or would you please do that. It's just like, they can't respond to it. And also, they find themselves very reluctant and difficult to admit mistakes. Because when they were children, when they admitted mistakes, what happened? They got beaten. So nowadays, when they're older, you know, 40, 50 years old, they can't say, well, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. You know, for those of us who come from cultures where you didn't get beaten like that, it's easy to say. You know, someone says, oh, you made a mistake. All right, Hare Krishna, I made a mistake. Let's go on with life. So it's interesting how your association, especially when you're young. Prabhupada actually said that. He said a child is a blank slate. And especially what happens when you're young influences you throughout the rest of your life. And in fact, there's many understandings of psychology where the psychologists actually take you back to your childhood. You know, they say, what happened in your childhood? In any case, we're not going to give a dissertation about psychology today, and or regression or anything like that. But what we come in contact with throughout this life influences our consciousness. So it's not just the birth or the type of family you were born in, it's the nurture, that's called nurture, how you're nurtured throughout your life. And in fact, Krishna in the Gita says, when you say, karnam guna sangasya sadasad janma jonishu, that one is entangled in this material world according to the guna sangha, the modes that he comes in contact with. I mean, that's why Prabhupada stressed very much avoiding bad associations. Lord Chaitanya stressed very much, and Prabhupada was repeating his words. He said, a satsanga chag, a Vaishnava char.
He said that's the quality of a Vaishnava. He avoids what? Asatsanga means bad association. A bad association means anything to do with the modes of nature. You know, you got association in the mode of ignorance. Or let's be more specific. You have music in the mode of ignorance. You have food in the mode of ignorance. You have pictures in the mode of ignorance. You have pictures in the mode of passion. You have food in the mode of passion. You have people in the mode of passion, and you have people in the mode of goodness. I mean, for example, music in the mode of ignorance would be like, I guess, punk music or something like that. I don't even know what it is anyway. Or, you know, slam dancing or something like that.
Death metal.
Yeah, metal, heavy metal. Death metal?
Death metal.
Never heard of it before. Death metal dancing, you know, or some crazy thing. You know, sometimes I see a picture on the internet of people dancing. It's just like, it's not like when I was young, they had passionate dancing. It was like the cha-cha or something, or the rumba or something. I don't know if any of you know what that
You're
is.
You're not that old.
What?
You're not that old.
Yes, I am. I'm 60. So, went to dance school and they taught me to dance the cha-cha, you know, anyway. So that's passion dancing. You know, Latin dancing. Actually, it's interesting. Now that I'm on this thing called Facebook on the internet, I see what my disciples are doing. And some of them, you know, they write on the internet, you know, I've gone Latin dancing last night. It's unbelievable. It's a real wake-up call for me to see what people are doing. But in any case, so that's passion or the mode of goodness. I guess it'd be classical music or something like that. And each of these things is entangling. Actually, the mode of goodness is entangling too, because it conditions one to it, a sense of happiness in this world, thinking that everything is all right, it's a beautiful place, let me stay here, there's no problems, etc. So that's karanam gunasangasha. And so if we actually want to advance, and that's a big if, you know, each and every one of us has to ask ourselves, do you want to advance in Krishna consciousness? If you don't, that's fine, we have no objection. Then go out and associate with the modes of nature. You know, eat food cooked by non-devotees. That's the methodology to become entangled. We're not prohibiting you. Just like sometimes devotees take these, you know, the principles that Prabhupada elaborated on as prohibitions. But they're more than prohibitions, they're actually injunctions for people who want to advance. So we should actually examine in our hearts, what do we want? What is our objective in life? Do we actually want to be with Krishna, or do we want to advance? Or do we just want to stay here and, as Prabhupada would say, rot in the material world? So there's a method to achieve each particular type of objective. So if you want to achieve the objective of going back to home, back to God, then you have to avoid, that's a negative. And it's, of course, in one sense, it's very hard to do a negative. You can't do a don't. So instead of just saying avoid bad association, you say take good association. Because when one associates with a sadhu, or with spiritual subject matter, spiritual, let's say, Vishuddha sattva, then mahatsevam horvi muktes. And then the other way is tamo dwaram yoshitam sanghi sangam. So in any case, getting back to the story, so this Bomasura, he went to school and he didn't have such good friends. He had some demon friends. They associated and they talked about, I guess, what demons normally talk about. I don't know what they talk about. You know, they went on the internet and looked at the wrong websites or something like that. And as a result, he actually became demoniac by mentality. And when he became demoniac mentality, his mother got really worried. This is an interesting story. It's some of the other Vedic literatures, Bhagavatam doesn't tell the whole story. But his mother got really worried. She said, my son's become a demon. And of course, a mother is naturally attached to her son or sons, even if they become little demons, right? I mean, just like Prabhupada said, you know, a mother who has a blind son is thinking the son has lotus eyes. So she was thinking, my son has become a demon, but he's my son. But then she was thinking, that's Bhumi, of course, the earth planet. She was actually thinking, my son has become a demon, then that means he may be killed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is problematic. But then she was thinking that actually God is my husband. Because Bhumi, there's like, if you go to South Indian temples, you'll see that the Lord is worshipped along with Sri and Bhu. Bhu refers to Bhumi. It's interesting. Bhumi is the goddess of the earth. That's true. But also she's the goddess, she's an expansion of the goddess who is the, predominating deity of the earth layer. You know, when you go out of the earth, go out of the material universe. So that's another Bhumi, who is the expansion of the Bhumi in the spiritual world, one of the Lord's eternal energies. So actually all these associates of the Lord, let's deviate for a second on the whole discussion, the whole story, all these associates of the Lord, such as these princesses, are actually expansions of personalities, let's say, on a higher realm. So, for example, these princesses are expansions of the gopis in Vrindavan, which is real interesting. And I'll tell a story about that at the end. So anyway, so Bhumi, she was all worried, you know, my son is going to be killed by my husband. So naturally, if you're worried about something like that, you go to your husband. And she went to her husband, Krishna, and she said, my dear husband. And he said, what do you want? And she said, please don't kill my son. And Krishna said, all right, I will not kill your son unless you give me permission. So she thought, wow, I got it made now. My son will never be killed by Krishna. He's safe and sound. All right. But Krishna is quite a tricky chap. You know, he knows how to get around, you know, promises, keep his promises, and get accomplish what he wants at the same time. So what happened in this particular story is when he went to attack Natakasura at all these princesses, he took with him Satyabhama. Satyabhama, of course, is a very interesting personality. She's an expansion of Srimati Radharani in the spiritual world. Let me tell a story about her before I get back to the main story. This story is told in the Lalita Madhava by Srila Rupa Goswami, that when Krishna left Vrindavan, and these pastimes occur in different ways, at different yuga cycles and everything like that. So this is one particular way the pastime occurred. I know it's a little bit different than what you're accustomed to. But in any case, when Krishna left Vrindavan, actually Radharani, in one particular story, the story, she actually left her body and went to the sun planet. And when she did this, also the sun god had the Shaimantaka jewel, which is originally coming from this demon, Shankachuda. There was this demon in Krishna's pastime, Shankachuda, who attempted to kidnap Radharani. And Krishna killed the demon. Everybody remember the story? Krishna killed the demon, took the jewel out of his forehead, and gave it to Balaram. And later on, that jewel got given to the sun god. So the sun god had Radharani there, and the jewel from the head of the Shankachuda. So he gave the jewel to Satrajit along with Radharani, who was expanding. And so the jewel became the what jewel? Shaimantaka jewel. That's the origin of the Shaimantaka jewel. And then Radharani became Satyabhama at that particular point. It's interesting. And so the Satrajit, he had both things. And of course, we know when he had this exchange with Krishna, and, you know, he refused to give the Shaimantaka jewel and everything like that, and then his brother was killed. Anyway, I'm not going to tell that whole story. But he gave Satyabhama to Krishna. And then when he gave Satyabhama to Krishna, what happened is that, oh yeah, Krishna is already married to Rukmini at that point. But Krishna had a problem. Because he had promised Rukmini that he would never marry anyone else without her permission. And so what was he going to do about the whole thing? So Satyabhama sort of resided in this place called Nava Vrindavan, which was actually a replica of Vrindavan, a garden. And there's some information about that in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, about Nava Vrindavan, not about this story. And so she resided there, and Krishna went to meet with her secretly when Rukmini wasn't looking. Interesting incident. Because Rukmini is considered an expansion of Chandravali in Vrindavan. Because Rukmini is actually a very submissive wife. Whereas Satyabhama is Bam. Bam means what? Left-handed. Right? Left-handed means not so submissive or argumentative wife. Actually, there's two types of wives that people can have. One is very submissive, and the other one just argues with them all the time. That's all right. Both are bona fide wives. So anyway, Satyabhama was meeting with Krishna. It's such an interesting story in the Lita Madhava. And she was meeting with Krishna in his garden, and even they had one particular cave they met in. And in that cave, there was actually on the wall, the cave was like a photographic album of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. And they would look, did you ever hear this story before? You probably, no, you haven't. So they would look at the pictures of their pastimes in Vrindavan on the wall. Pretty interesting. And they said, oh, here's me killing this demon, here's us dancing, you know. Just like you go with your family members through photographic albums, anyone ever done that? You know, you look, oh, here's me when I was a little baby, here's me when, you know, here's my mommy and daddy. So they were doing that. And then they came to one picture that Radharani didn't like. She said, I don't want to see that picture, nonsense picture. And that was a picture of Akrura taking Krishna out of Vrindavan. So that was the one picture they wanted to take out of the photographic album. So Satyabhama is actually expansion of Radharani. And so the reason we're telling this is that Bhumi is actually an expansion of Satyabhama. So Bhumi and Satyabhama, they're the same person. You know, when we talk about expansions, these are Shakti Tattva personalities. These are not Vishnu Tattva personalities. I mean, not Vishnu Tattva nor Jiva Tattva personalities. In other words, we don't have expansions like that. In the spiritual world, we as Jiva souls can be in several places at one time. That is true. We can be with Lord Chaitanya. We can be with Lord Krishna in different parts of Goloka Vrindavan. But we don't have the same sort of expansion like Vibhava Prakash, Vilas Prakash, or whatever that's discussed here in this particular purport. So when Krishna was confronting Bhumasura, and Bhumasura was getting ready to attack Krishna, guess who gave him permission to kill him? Satyabhama, who is the original, the origin of Bhumi. So Satyabhama said, kill him, and Krishna said, well, now I got permission. Now I can kill him. So when Krishna got permission, then he was actually keeping his promise and making an end run around the promise he made to Bhumi. So Krishna is so darn tricky. You know, when he wants to do something, he always figures out a way to do it, and he keeps his promises too. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, Kanteya pratijani hi nami vakta pranashati. You should declare it boldly that my devotee will never perish. And Prabhupada explains that Krishna is so tricky that people won't always believe him. When Krishna says something, you know, what is he doing? You know, he has some trick behind his back, you know, like he's crossing his fingers or something. But when Krishna's devotee says something, then people will believe, because when Krishna's devotee says something, Krishna has to do what the devotee promises and what the devotee says, because Krishna is controlled by the devotee. He's controlled. That's one of the aspects of pure devotional service. It's the only means of controlling Krishna, attracting Krishna. Therefore, Radharani is known as Madan Mohan Mohini, the attractor of the attractor of Cupid. So Krishna got permission. He killed the demon, and that was the end of the demon. And then he had these princesses who were actually expansions of the gopis in Vrindavan. And they were actually internal potency personalities. And then he married them. And it's interesting also, in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, it mentions that Krishna marries his wives because they remind him of the gopis in Vrindavan. In fact, he even tells Satyabhama, who I mentioned before, who is not a submissive wife. I mean, she loves Krishna. Everything she does is... That's another point. I should clarify that. That she's not submissive, but her unsubmissiveness is to please Krishna. It's like spicing in a preparation. Like sometimes in a preparation, you will put hot pepper, right? Hot pepper by itself, red pepper, is not very pleasing. But when you mix it with things, it gives you a very special taste in the preparation that you wouldn't get otherwise. So the rasas, the different tastes of the relationships with Krishna, of course there's five primary rasas, are flavored by the indirect rasas. These indirect rasas are like different types of spices, like asafoetida, hot pepper, you know, all these, masala, it's called a masala. Everyone knows what a masala is? Masala is like a combination of spices. So the indirect rasas are the masala that spices the direct rasas. So when you see someone like Satyabhama insubmissive, or not being submissive, or Radharani talking back to Krishna, or in the pastimes of Vrindavan, the gopis actually sometimes hitting Krishna with a stick and tying him up to a tree, Krishna enjoys that. It's the spice of life. Because if Krishna always had the wives who were just like, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, it would get boring. And Krishna doesn't like to get bored. You need spice. Like Prabhupada said, variety is the mother of enjoyment. Like Krishna even tries to get Rukmini angry sometimes. Of course, he's not very successful at it. Like when he told her she should get remarried, you know, even though she was a grandmother at that particular point. And he said, you've married the wrong person here. You know, go marry someone else. So this spices things up. So Satyabhama is unsubmissive, and Krishna, but Krishna said to her one time, actually this is in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when she was very angry when she saw Krishna, she was envious, when she saw Krishna's love for the residents of Vrindavan, he said, actually, I don't love you anyway. The only reason I got married to you was because you remind me of my girlfriends. All you married men should say that to your wives and see what happens. Stand back, you know. You're in trouble. So you remind me of my girlfriends. Actually, he said to Satyabhama, I had no intention of getting married to anyone. I wanted to be a brahmachari. And so, you know, one may think, brahmachari? What's Krishna talking about? But Krishna, even though he was dancing with all these girls in the middle of the night in Vrindavan, he never felt any material agitation, because he has a spiritual body. So he's real Brahman. He's actual brahmachari. There's stories about that in Vrindavan. Krishna is a brahmachari. So, therefore, he told Satyabhama that. He said, actually, I had no intention of getting married, but I had got this letter from Rukmini, and Rukmini was in trouble. I had to save her. So, you know, I had no alternative. I had to get married. So if I had to marry one, you know, I figure, you know, if I can't be a brahmachari, I might as well marry a lot of women. And so then Krishna married 16,108 wives. But it's described here that each and every one of them got a chance to interact with Krishna, exchange loving mellows in a way that was very appropriate for that particular individual. In other words, yetamam prabhajante tam sataiva bhajamiham, on the spiritual platform. As each and every one approached Krishna, dealt with Krishna, had a specific mood. What does this mean for us? That means each and every one of us has a very specific individual relationship with Krishna. And Krishna will react or interact with us, in a way that is very personal with us. Krishna can do that because he's God. So we should be inspired by this. It's not like, you know, we got to wait our turn in the spiritual world, but take a number, you know, to be with Krishna. It's just that Krishna will actually, he knows who we are. He's waiting. Not only does he know who we are, he's waiting for us. Just like that story in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, again, when this Gopa Kumar went back to the spiritual world, Krishna was waiting for him, and he was happy to see him. And Krishna has unlimited associates in the spiritual world, but still he's waiting for us. That's very personal, isn't it? Isn't that nice? Krishna's waiting for us, you know, little old me. And even though he has everything. That is real love, and that is God. So this is inspiring for us too, so we won't be lacking in Krishna's relationship or Krishna's association. Just like the coward boys, when they're sitting down taking prasad with Krishna, everyone is thinking that Krishna is looking just at them. So these are some points. So any questions or comments about any of the points we made in class? Yeah.
I didn't quite follow. It was a very interesting class, Maharaj. I didn't quite follow one point, but may I ask?
Yeah.
Was that you explained how Krishna made an end run around his promise to not kill Asura.
Bhoma. His name was Bhoma, and then later became Bhomasura, right?
Yeah. But you also said that he made an end run around his promise not to kill him,
yeah. Without the permission. He promised not to kill him.
That was clear. That I understood.
Yeah.
But the one I didn't catch was the promise that he made to Satyabhama that he wouldn't marry any other wives.
No, he married Rukmini.
Oh, he made the Rukmini, yeah, right. But he got...
Finally, he got her permission, yeah. If you read...
How was that?
She relented when she saw that Krishna was actually a nice husband. If you read the Lalita Madhava, I'm not suggesting you read the Lalita Madhava, but anyway, I've read it. So in Rupa Goswami, Lalita Madhava is a book by Rupa Goswami, which details the pastimes of Krishna out of Vrindavan, which is actually very similar to the title here of this particular chapter, The Lord's Pastimes Out of Vrindavan. And the Vidugdha Madhava talks about Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. It's not like a super intimate book. It's not one of those books that, you know, that'll confuse you or anything like that. It describes that eventually, you know, Rukmini, and there's more details to the story. That Satyabhama actually first became Rukmini's servant and like that, and she was serving Rukmini so nicely that finally she agreed that Krishna could marry her. Yeah, there's more to the story, obviously. I mean, if I told the whole story, the Lalita Madhava would be here for, you know, several days at least. But it's such an interesting book. I mean, we've been left a real wealth of literature, of information, philosophy, and pastimes by the Goswamis of Vrindavan. We're so fortunate. I mean, whenever I read, of course, mainly I'm reading Prabhupada's books, but whenever I read some of the Goswami's books or other books, I just become so amazed at how fortunate we are to have been left all this. And how, of course, here you have the BBT. The BBT is just like the heart of the Krishna consciousness movement because it's connecting us with Srila Prabhupada and all the past acharyas. And that's giving us, it's like the powerhouse. Here's something you could quote. It's giving the energy to everything, even though something may be thousands of miles away. Just like I was reading, and there's some proposal to produce power in Africa, in the desert. You heard about this before? There's a big desert in Africa. Big deserts in Africa, you know, whatever. And they want to put all these mirrors in and focus them, you know, many, many, like hundreds of acres, and focus them and produce power, and then transmit that power to Europe, and it'll provide, I think, 15%. Of the power that you need in Europe. So I was thinking in the same way that, you know, we have the BBT and the production of the book, Spiritual Literatures, and even though a devotee may be thousands of miles away, it's producing the power that keeps the devotee fixed in Krishna consciousness and engages the devotee in Krishna consciousness and keeps our movement stable. So this is like the heart. The BBT is like the heart of the Krishna consciousness movement. You can quote me on that if you want. So, I don't know why I talked about that. Anyway, so, yes, other questions?
You were speaking about how Krishna, Bhumi asked him to, he said he would only do it by her permission.
Yeah.
Satyabhama's permission,
yeah. He had a trick.
Are Satyabhama and Bhumi, is Bhumi aware that he did this with Satyabhama? Is Satyabhama aware that Bhumi asked for his promise?
No, Satyabhama was not aware. It's just like, under Yogamaya, like you have Balaram sometimes, who's not aware of why Krishna is doing things. Although Balaram and Krishna, they're the same. Advaita Chutamanada Ananta Rupamajam Purana Purusham Naviyoganam Cha. Even the Lord gets bewildered by his Yogamaya potency. I mean, like when the coward boys marched into the mouth of the Agasura demon, Krishna was thinking, oh my God. You know, he's God. And he's thinking, oh my God. But then he's thinking, you know, what am I going to do? And, you know, obviously, you know, if he remembered he was God, he wouldn't have to do anything. He would just have to wish that the Agasura demon would just, like, burst into ashes. Because Krishna doesn't have to act. His energies are actually first-class servants. They actually act when he wants something. So, so this is Yogamaya. This is actually a pastime. A pastime. So I guess eventually Bhumi found out how she was tricked by Krishna. And Satyabhama eventually found out. But, you know, that's part of being married to Krishna. You know, you have to put up with things like that. Isn't it part of being a Krishna's wife? You know he's going to do things that are also tricky like that. And he's going to get away with them. That's the downside of being married to Krishna. I'm speaking facetiously, obviously. And there's no downside of being married to Krishna. I mean, just like being Krishna's mother. And you just have to expect he's going to do tricky things like, you know, pinch babies and steal butter and feed it to monkeys and stuff like that. Or Lord Chaitanya's mother, you'll have to understand he's going to do tricky things like put sticky things in the girl's hair and, you know, spit on the brahmanas while they're saying their Gayatri mantra, or dive under the water and pull the brahman's legs out from under them while they're saying the Gayatri. I mean, that's part of being the Lord's father or mother or related to the Lord in any way. And as devotees of Krishna, we, in our personal lives, we have to expect Krishna to be pretty tricky too. And I've seen that. My own experience in Krishna consciousness is you don't know what Krishna's going to do day to day. It's quite interesting. Frightening sometimes, but interesting. So any other questions or comments? Yeah.
Maharaj, in the verse that was quoted in the purport there, Vedeshu Durlabham Adurlabham Atma Bhakto.
Vedeshu Durlabham Adurlabham Atma Bhakto.
It says that the Vedas are, that the Krishna is inaccessible through the Vedas.
Yeah.
So why are we producing so many books?
Well, the interesting thing is that when we produce books, there is a commentary. You know, commentary, purport. And so we are actually accessing the Vedic literatures, the information in the Vedic literatures, through Krishna's devotee, which is what it says here. Adurlabham Atma Bhakta, but can be, Krishna can be accessed through his devotee. So we have Srila Prabhupada's purport, which we read here. And actually, it's interesting you ask that question, because of the Upanishads, for example, the meaning of the Upanishads is that one must approach the spiritual master to understand the Upanishads, the Vedic literatures. The way the Vedic literatures are arranged is that one must approach a guru or someone who is self-realized to understand the Vedic literatures. Yeah, also the statement in the Mahabharata is Tarko Pratishtha Shruti Dhanavina. You know that statement? That one cannot understand the absolute truth by logic, by reasoning, by reading the Vedic literatures, but only by what? Mahajanayena Katha Sapanta, following the footsteps of the great personalities, the Mahajanas, the Mahatmas. So this is the same point that's made here in this particular verse. Vedeshu Durlabham, cannot, very difficult. Durlabham actually means difficult. It's very difficult to understand Krishna through the Vedas. But Adurlabham, in front of the word means the opposite. Adurlabham Atma Bhakto, through Krishna's devotee, is very easy. So we have purports. And that's why, you know, the BBT publishes the books with the purports, and it's better that you read the BBT books rather than just like go and find anyone's translation of the of these books. I mean, so you have to be very careful when approaching the Vedic literatures. Also, if you approach literatures that have been translated by someone who is not Krishna conscious, or purported by someone who is not Krishna conscious, it can have adverse effects on your consciousness. I remember, you know, just recently someone gave me a copy of some book, you know, and I picked it up and I got scared when I picked it up, because I could feel that I was being contaminated by reading it, because the person wasn't Krishna conscious. who had translated it. I mean, not only can a translator mistranslate something, because translation is actually a very difficult thing. I remember years ago, I was in charge of the Spanish BBT and organizing the translation, the original translation of the Gita and everything like that. And we had to have a special person, a fidelity checker, when you do the translation, because there's not always a correspondence for each and every word, each and every expression, as you know, from one language to another. So it was, sometimes the translators would argue over one word for several days. Did you ever have that experience?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, not so much here, but in China, they've been arguing over a few words for the past 10 years.
Wow.
Wars. A few words. Camps amongst the devotees over a few words.
My God.
Key terms.
Really? And in Spanish, it's like that too, because you got different types of Spanish in different parts of the world. I mean, I remember that the devotees in Spain didn't want to accept the books that we translated in Latin America. You probably know about that. So it was just like, I'm sorry. So translation is not something simple, especially from Sanskrit, which is even a more difficult language to translate. It must be a self-realized person, you know, was translating from Sanskrit. So therefore we need, you know, a BBT to actually supervise these particular things so we can actually get the pure knowledge from our acharyas and the pure knowledge from the purports like that. Very important. Yeah, devotees should not be approaching the Vedic literature directly because it's very dangerous. You can get bewildered. I mean, you read the Mahabharata, you can get bewildered. Even the editions of the Mahabharata that have come out are sometimes very bewildering as far as, you know, Krishna's position. That's why Śrīla Vyāsadeva was chastised by Narada Muni, you know, because it doesn't directly point out that devotional service is the topmost goal. And also, Śrīpāda Madhvacārya says that the Mahabharata has actually been changed dramatically, drastically throughout the years. There's been parts that have been added, parts that have been taken out, parts that have been changed in the Mahabharata. Very difficult to ascertain what is the original Mahabharata. Srimad Bhagavatam we have, Bhagavad Gita we have the original book, and of course the books of the Goswamis. So, any other questions or comments? Arguments, problems, issues? No? Yeah, Brahma?
I have a question, but not directly related to this.
Okay.
But you mentioned it in the beginning, the keyword and regression.
Yeah.
My question is, how does hypnosis work? Do we have an explanation for hypnosis?
That's an interesting question.
Because it definitely works.
Yeah, well...
But how is this happening?
Well, we have a subtle body in addition to a gross body. And that subtle body has the impressions from all of our past, you know, experiences and births in this world. And fortunately, because of the, like Krishna explains in the Gita, Prabhupada explains, because of the changes in the gross body, we forget these things generally. But sometimes people have spontaneous memories, especially with a child, you'll find, you know, children sometimes they'll tell you, well, I was just with Krishna in the battle of Kurukshetra or something. Not exactly like that, but you'll find some really interesting things that come out of children's mouths. And
not necessarily under hypnosis, or?
No. Not necessarily under hypnosis. But just because they're in touch more with their subtle body, they haven't been yet so, let us say, conditioned in this lifetime. Children are much more like clear and innocent. Children can see through us adults much easier than we can see through each other. You know, they pick up on things much easier. So my understanding is that, you know, hypnosis or trance, you know, you may call it trance under yogic trance or something like that, you can actually come in contact somehow or other with your subtle body and with the impressions, because the memories are there. Memories are there in the subtle body, and then become aware of things. And there's another method too, which is astrology. You know, with astrology, just like with Lord Chaitanya, you know, they actually said, you know, in the past, the astrologers said, in the past you were a coward boy or something like that, or a great king, you know. And Lord Chaitanya actually said, yes, in the past I was a coward boy. So I mean, even there's something. And even Prabhupada talked about his past birth. He said, I was a very pious person. I forget exactly the details, but You know, it's there.
Physician, wasn't it?
What?
He was a physician.
Physician, yeah, that's right. Physician. Pious physician in a past life. So even Prabhupada talked about the past life like that. Although, it's interesting, but, you know, I'm personally not that interested in my past life because I'm trying to make the best of the present life like that. Even if I was doing something interesting in the past life, like, you know, being killed in the battle, of course, etc. I'm worried about what I'm going to do right now. So Prabhupada sort of indicated that we shouldn't be that much absorbed in, like, astrology or, you know what happened in the past or what's going to happen in the future. Prabhupada actually said when we chant and dance, it changes all the lines on the palm. There was one story one devotee told me that astrologer, oh yeah, yeah. This person, the lady was going to have a child, so she went to an astrologer and said, "My dear astrologer, is it a boy or a girl?" And the astrologer said, "I'm sure it's a girl." But then later on, I came a boy, so. So, it's very hard to find an expert astrologer. And even so, I think Krishna consciousness, not I think, I know Krishna consciousness is transcendental to all those things. Yeah. Oh.
Like Krishna was departed from planet, and Arjuna was transferring his sweets from Dwaraka, and they was like, somebody stole them.
Kidnapped by a bunch of cowards, yeah.
Yeah, but I hear something like this was like Krishna in some form or something.
Yeah.
How this was? I just...
Krishna assumed the form of all these cowherds to kidnap his wives and take them back with him. That story is there in the Bhagavatam. Prama, you had another question?
Yeah, Krishna arranges, or I'm not exactly sure how it's arranged, but the arrangement is that when we change the body,
we forget
everything.
Yeah.
Right? There's hardly anything
we remember.
Remember, you say that there is the subtle body.
Subtle body.
Carries.
Carries it, yeah.
It carries some of the talents.
And also
desires.
remembrances. If you could access the subtle body, you'd actually remember what you were did in the past.
So, I wonder how right it is to try to
remember
circumvent that arrangement and remember past life especially past life.
Yeah.
Isn't it dangerous?
I think it can be dangerous because when we come caught up in that, just like when you hear from an astrologer, it can also be dangerous that, you know, you're supposed to have spiritual trouble now for the next, you're going through the Saturn period. You know, I've seen that happen before. You know, you tell a devotee, you're going through your Saturn period, you know, life is going to be really tough. And so the person starts to have spiritual trouble just because of the power of suggestion. And then then you'll say to him, "What's wrong, Prabhu? I'm in my Saturn period. Don't expect me to chant." Later on, you know, in 2 years from now, I'm going to be a good devotee. I got a Hare Krishna. And anyway, so it can be quite dangerous, and Prabhupada never indicated we should delve into that so much. But anyway, and also devotional service dissolves the subtle body. That's another thing Prabhupada said. When you chant, you're dissolving that subtle body and getting a spiritual body instead, so whatever. But I mean, even if we discover what we were doing, how does that help us? I mean,
But on the other hand, if we forget about the past lives, but if we deal with this life of a person, and you just said the word suggestion,
power of suggestion,
very, very powerful,
yeah,
extremely powerful. So why don't we use hypnosis to wipe out our tastes for the material world
We do use hypnosis.
It should work.
No, but you want to know something very interesting?
Okay.
We do use hypnosis.
Yes. Okay, go ahead.
Just like hypnosis is not just like because I'm actually a certified hypnotist, you probably know. Hypnosis is not just like look at the pen or look at the diamond. You're getting sleepy, your eyes are closed, like that. It's also, when we repeat something enough times, it puts someone into what's called a light hypnotic state, which is called a hypnoidal state. And like a or the power of suggestion. I mean, I'll tell you how I used it one time. I was doing a fundraising dinner, and I was saying to people that each and every time you eat a pakora, you'll feel like giving money.
Wow.
You know, I was giving the lecture. I said, you know, we have wonderful prasadam, and I know as you eat that prasadam, every time you, you know, I didn't say it in a hypnotic way. Every time you eat prasadam, you will think of how wonderful Krishna consciousness is, and then you'll feel enthusiastic to give a donation. So it's called a post-hypnotic suggestion. So, I mean, I was using that deliberately. It was funny. I mean, people knew what I was doing. They were laughing. But I did it. And we do the same thing. We give a lot of post-hypnotic suggestions. And we have to be careful about which ones we give. Like we say, you know, you're not doing very well. You're going to fall down. Like, I'll give you a horrible example I just had that I didn't do. But wasn't aware what he was doing. It was a sannyasi. He was preaching to someone to stay with his wife. You know, whether he was right, whether he was wrong, that's another issue. But he said, unless you stay with her, you're going to fall down from Krishna consciousness. And he said, you know, sometimes in Indian culture it gets really wild like this. They're all both Indians. So he said, and all your forefathers are going to hell. He really scared the bejesus out of the poor guy. The guy called me immediately. He said, everyone's going to hell because of me. You know, and he didn't even want to be married. He never even talked to his wife because it was an arranged marriage where the parents just like forced him to go to this fire sacrifice. You know, he was there at the fire sacrifice. Let it stop, you know. So that's like a post-hypnotic suggestion too, you know. So he's thinking he's going to fall down, and he may fall down because of the post-hypnotic suggestion. And also, it's because there's something called natural hypnosis too, which occurs just as a normal. So this is, you know, we're trying to like pierce through the subtle body too, to the subtle body too. We're actually, I mean, I'm not deliberately using hypnotic techniques, but you'll see Bhagavad Saptaha people, they deliberately use hypnotic techniques when they, yeah. What they do, this is really interesting, you can watch for next time you see Bhagavad Saptaha, is that they're speaking very softly. Some devotees actually do this when they're giving class. They're speaking very softly, and then all of a sudden, DAH! You know, loudly. So what that does is it overloads the mind so that one can actually access the subtle body. It's a technique. Anyway, I know about all these things, and I deliberately don't use them in Bhagavatam class because it's not, I don't wouldn't feel honest about it if I was using it. Like I would, you know, you'll find people giving class, and they'll go, all of a sudden they'll go, Krishna! And what that does is allows them to access your, I'm not saying they do it deliberately, but allows them to access the subconsciousness. It's a technique that hypnotists use. To do that, it's anyway, it's dishonest.
What happened to the pakora at the pakora fundraiser?
It was pretty successful. For fundraising, you know, it's all right to use it.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I can teach you a lot of techniques so you can raise money. But the Sankirtan devotees sometimes use that too. You know, they'll flip through the book. It's a very nice book. It's this and that. And they're speaking so quickly. It overloads the person. That's a hypnotic technique, to overload the person with sensory experience. Because we have an ability to, let's say, process 8 bits of information simultaneously, not more than that. And once we're overloaded, overloading can happen through various means. It can happen when we're just like in a room where there's a lot of people screaming and yelling like that. Or it can also happen in television. The advertising media, the companies, they're well aware of this. So when they have children watching cartoons, the advertisements will be flashing very, very quickly at them, and it puts the children in a hypnoidal state. You've probably seen the children watching it. They're like this, and then all of a sudden, buy this, get your parents to buy this. So after the film is over, or you know, movie or TV show, is over, they come to their parents, I must have this. You must get me that.
Yeah. Even days after that.
Yeah, days after, it lasts. I mean, the advertising agencies, they studied psychology much more than they studied technology, because that's how they, you know, they influence you. That, and the politicians also. I mean, they're all expert in these things. There was one book written in the 1960s called The Hidden Persuaders. It talked a little bit about these techniques and how the advertising people are using techniques like that.
That's so dangerous. Television is so
dangerous. Very dangerous. Very dangerous. Because also it's a flashing, television is flashing at some either 50 frames a second or 60, depending what part of the world you're in. And that flashing, or the movie flashing, actually puts you in a semi-hypnoidal trance. Which, and then you're what's called hyper-suggestible. Hyper-suggestible means that people can suggest things to you and you'll do it, or it'll influence your consciousness. And so we have to, you know, as devotees, it's important, actually, it's good you asked that question. As devotees, we have to be aware of these things so we're not controlled by others. I mean, give an example like Hitler. He used all those techniques. And just look at how, if you ever look at his lectures, you know, his talks between thousands of people, like that, and it's just like very hypnotic. Practically any charismatic person will be using these particular techniques. I deliberately don't use them. But, you know, they're very easy to use.
I studied some of his speeches.
Yeah.
He, especially with the young people, he didn't tell them what they should think or what they should do.
Mm-hmm.
He told them what they think.
Yeah, he told them what they think.
And what they think they should do. He didn't tell them, you should do this. He said, you think that you should do this.
Yeah.
And in this way he suggested.
He suggested.
Very powerful suggestion.
But the way, his methodology of he was actually, I just read about that. He got training from a professional theater people. I was just reading about his history. And he got training in oration and like that, like the different techniques. See, there's hand motions too that you use. And then, you know, just you vary your voice from very low to high very quickly, like he does. And that really just makes someone hyper-suggestible. And you're thinking, like you said, you're thinking like this, you know. We're thinking, you know, we're being exploited by the, you know. And it's a very powerful technique. But we as devotees should be independently thoughtful and not controlled like that. Blind following is not. I mean, we really don't want to follow our spiritual master or Krishna in a blind way like that. And we want to just be really introspective, thoughtful, what are we doing? Otherwise, we'll be just members of a cult. Yeah.
When we go to Vrindavan, do we have to take books? What is a good meditation to kind of hold on to?
Well, the meditation I utilize is that I'm praying to Krishna in the heart of the person who I'm approaching. And just saying, Krishna, soften their heart so they can, you know, appreciate this book. But anyway, there's different book distribution techniques, but just as far as the meditation, that's what I would, what I do.
So you have a focus on that it's good for this person?
It's good for the person. You know, I'm praying to Krishna in the heart.
Mm-hmm.
The Krishna, you're in their heart, you can give them the intelligence. And Prabhupada actually prayed the same thing in his poem when he came over to the Western world, you know, Krishna, you can make them understand. It was, what's that called? Markandeya Dharma or something like that was the name of the poem. So it's a similar type of make them dance or something like that. And I forget the exact wording of that poem. So, yeah. That's how I was guessing. Ananda, you had a question?
Yeah. If a spiritual master can't make it or leave the body, who will instruct his disciples in the next lifetime?
If a spiritual master doesn't make it, you mean he doesn't become Krishna conscious? Or?
Yeah, leaves ISKCON.
Oh, he leaves ISKCON. Well, now that's another subject matter. But my personal opinion, and I'm not a Ritvik, you know, I hope not. It'd be disappointing for my disciples. Anyway, so my personal opinion is that, you know, Srila Prabhupada's instructions, position, and everything like that should be you know, central in the Krishna Conscious Movement, any one of us, whether we're a spiritual master, temple president, or whatever, we're seen as assisting Srila Prabhupada. That's it. You know, we're just assisting Srila Prabhupada. And then Ramanuja Sampradaya, Shripad Ramanujacharya, he is actually, you know, the primary guru for everybody. And the gurus who initiate are actually assisting him, you know, thinking of assisting. They're gurus, and, you know, they have their disciples. But the siksha is actually much more important than the diksha. And that's what our disciplic succession is like, too. It's a siksha disciplic succession, one of instruction, rather than... And just like you see Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he was initiated by Bipini Vihari Goswami, yet his connection with him was not very important. His connection with Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj was the important thing. So I think all of us, none of us is going to be bereft, because if we actually take shelter of Srila Prabhupada, his instructions. Another point is, I mean, apart from the gurus, I think that we have a problem in our movement that many people try to imitate Prabhupada. And that's not just a comment on the gurus. That's a comment on any of us who tries to take an absolute position utilizing Srila Prabhupada's words. And doing that, I've seen, you know, devotees abuse other devotees. And that's not, we're not talking about gurus, we're just talking to everybody. You know, or people go on Sankirtan and just take an absolute position rather than a compassionate position. So I think in general we have to avoid imitating Prabhupada. We should all realize we're just servants of His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, and His mission. And if we do that, then we always have shelter. You know, we have shelter of Prabhupada. Everybody. I mean, because Prabhupada is the preeminent, predominant, central, you know, I can think of a million other words, personality in our lives. And others are helping us connect with Srila Prabhupada. And Srila Prabhupada is absolute. You know, it's interesting, you know, Prabhupada, because he was spoke from the absolute platform, he could, his manner of speaking was, you know, very absolute. But we should not be speaking like that, too. You know, we should not be going around telling people they're rascals. You know, I remember one Sankirtan devotee, he would just repeat Prabhupada's words in Sankirtan, calling the people in the street hogs, dogs, camels, and asses. You know, which... You know, it's right there in the Vedic literatures, but, you know, we can't do that. We can't do that. You know, and Prabhupada, what was that conversation, Prabhupada? It was a really interesting. A professor came to see Prabhupada, and he was a professor of Hinduism. And Prabhupada asked him, so what is Hinduism? And the professor said, I don't know. And then Prabhupada turned to the devotees in the room and said, what do we call that, my dear devotees? And the devotees said, rascal. Yes, Prabhupada said, yes, you are a rascal. Maybe you heard that conversation. It's in the latest... Yeah. And at Ravindra Sruprabhu, I brought this professor to see Prabhupada. And so, you know, we shouldn't be doing that. You know, or dealing, you know, if you happen to be a guru, you shouldn't be dealing with your disciples like that either. Everything, you know, it's a different method of dealing than Prabhupada had with us or with anybody. It's like we don't deal with the way, in the same way that Krishna dealt with everybody. We don't deal in the same way that Prabhupada. The problem is when Prabhupada left the planet, the gurus originally thought that they just had to become imitation Prabhupadas. They thought somehow or other they'd become pure devotees, which would be amazing. Just, I wish it was so easy that you just become a guru and you're a pure devotee. Then we make everybody gurus. Anyway, and they began to imitate Prabhupada. But they didn't have the stature, the position. They weren't interested in devotees. So then we had so many problems in the movement.
Even when you have the stature,
you shouldn't do it. Even if you have the stature, and I don't know if anyone has the stature, I'm not qualified to comment on that. But you don't imitate, because the etiquette is Prabhupada is the founder of Acharya Viscon, you know. So we should all act like humble servants of Prabhupada. I mean, we can preach. I'm sitting up here and, you know, actually speaking. But, you know, I'm just... And we're all... Another point is we're all God brothers and God sisters, regardless of who we're initiated by. I mean, just this whole hierarchical concept that we have, you know, is just like... I mean, I, at least myself from the West, I can't really stomach hierarchies that much. that, you know, I was initiated 2 minutes before you, you know, so I get to take prasadam before you, or I'm a man and that's a woman, you know, we're much better than you, you know, just roll those japatis, you know, that's your business, you know. You know, I somehow or other, it just strikes me the wrong way, those hierarchy things. I mean, I know we have Vaishnava etiquette, but at the same time, you know, we are just one family. Now, I was talking to devotees the other day, like, even when I go to Vrindavan, and I stay at Govardhan a lot, and I see the residents there, I also think of them just like my family members. I don't think because I'm an ISKCON, you know, I'm better than all these, you know, people who are begging in the streets. I think they're my family members, I want to help them, you know. So there has to be this conception that, you know, we're all in it together here, rather than, you know, I'm so much better than you. You know, I'm a Prabhupada disciple. Bring me the prasadam. Anyway, so, yeah.
But sometimes the position gives you a certain responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
People learn to do things the right way. And your Prabhupada disciples, it's also your responsibility to train.
Yes. But if you're thinking, there's practical action, and then there's consciousness. Like you, if you're a parent, yes, you're thinking that in order to take care of the children, I have to do this and this and this and this and whatever. But if you're thinking I am better than them, that's another point, and that leads to problematic action. Yeah, obviously. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm sannyasi, I have disciples. You know, there's some etiquette, there's external etiquette, but if I'm thinking, you know, these people are just meant to serve me, that's not so good. You know, or, you know, obviously, and I have to train up people, I understand duty. But the internal consciousness is, you know, we're here serving Krishna, and we're all connected, we're all family. Yeah, every one of us is family, yeah.
I don't know about guru-disciple relationship, but with children, I see that actually you don't have to be that strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to show the example.
Yeah.
If you show the example, they accept it quite, at least that's my experience for you. Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe it's an extraordinary child, but my daughter accepts the example
mm-hmm.
very willingly, extremely
mm-hmm.
nicely and willingly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Because if you're strong in the sense of just like demanding things of someone, they ultimately rebel anyway.
I guess with a guru and disciple, it's similar.
Yeah, it's the same thing,
isn't it?
It's basically the example. Like Prabhupada said, example is more important than precept.
Mm.
So I mean, obviously you have to give instructions sometimes too, but it should be done lovingly. I mean, if you do it from the point of, you know, that I'm the boss and you got to follow me, you've lost your authority. Anytime the guru says to the disciple, I'm your guru and you must follow me because I'm your guru, you actually lost the authority of your position at that point.
But sometimes it's also risky to be humble, you know, to actually take the trouble to train people. And,
yeah, and, you know, it's our responsibility. It's a duty that I've been given by my spiritual master to help train people in Krishna consciousness. I mean, giving class, but if I became too humble, you know, too humble, you know, if I just understood things in the wrong way, I wouldn't be sitting here speaking about Krishna consciousness. So fortunately, Prabhupada's given me some, you know, knowledge or realization or something like that, so I'm sharing it. But I'm not thinking, as I'm sitting here, I'm not thinking, you know, I'm better than you or more advanced than you or anything like that. I'm thinking that I have to serve Srini, who just pointed his watch and said, he just went, Maharaj, you have to end class. Okay. So Srini just told me I have to end, so I'm thinking I have to follow what he says. So. Okay? I think we have to end. All right, all glory to the divine grace to the Prabhupada. Ha 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 ha.